This is an Oxford-style debate, and you, the audience, will vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. You will vote before the start of the debate and once again following the conclusion of the debate. You can go to sohovote.com now using the Sheen Center Wi-Fi displayed on the screen to register your vote. Initial voting will close at the beginning of the debate, and voting will reopen at the conclusion of closing arguments. You must vote before and after the debate for your vote to count. Thanks again for coming out tonight. And to moderate tonight's debate is the director of the Soho Forum, Gene Epstein.
Thank you, Lucas. Welcome to you all. Welcome to those who are watching this debate on streaming. The Soho Forum, which I began in 2016, September of 2016, could not have been possible without the help at that point of the Smith Family Foundation. And they are still one of our main donors, and we are grateful to them for keeping us afloat. Ever since 2016, the Soho Forum has been a labor of love for me. It continues to be, and so I love you all for coming. The debate resolution this evening reads, again, the government should offer to all Americans a health insurance plan that would compete with private insurance plans. Think about it, and then vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution. We had a brilliant software engineer devise the program for us so that if you vote the first time but not the second time, your vote won't count. If you vote the second time but you didn't vote the first time, your vote won't count. You must vote both times, yes, no, or undecided on the resolution, so that we can see who wins the Soho Forum Tootsie Roll. We are also grateful to the Reason Foundation for quite early on taking us on and handling all our administrative matters, as well as releasing all our debates on YouTube and on a podcast on their Reason channel. We have more than 100 debates on file at thesohoforum.org. A number of them have gotten 100,000 or more downloads. One has gotten more than 1 million, and one more has gotten 8 million. And that was a debate between the socialist Richard, the eminent Richard Wolff, debating me. And so I'm proud of that and amazed that it keeps rising inexorably. It was at 7 million last September, and then it surpassed 8 million. I credit it completely to the celebrity of Richard Wolff, for sure, because I debated two other socialists, and that got 100,000 apiece. So that was a test case. It wasn't me. It was obviously Richard. Almost any topic of interest that might occur to you, if you browse through our past events, you will find listed on our Soho Forum. Tonight's event will also be permanently on our Soho Forum website. As mentioned, we are grateful to the Reason Foundation for all that they have done to put us on that channel, as well as to handle all our administrative expenses. We actually don't technically exist as a nonprofit. We exist by virtue of simply being a satellite of the Reason Foundation. And here to say a few words, Reason Editor-at-Large Nick Gillespie.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming out. By the way, when that debate between Gene and Richard Wolff hits 10 million, the state will wither away. We don't know if it'll be libertarian or socialist, but let's find out. So I want to thank you all for coming out, and I just want to remind you what Reason is. Founded in 1968, Reason is the nation, the planet's only magazine of free minds and free markets. We're a libertarian journalism organization. There are copies floating around. Please check it out. The latest issue is our special double travel issue, 34 places to find freedom. One of them is my grandparents, my Italian grandparents' hometown, where I went and I found out that everything I've been told about the immigrant experience of my mother's family was basically lies. So that's one reason to travel. There is actually a place in New York, so check it out. Amazing that there's a place in New York to find freedom. It's a great issue. It summarizes what we do. We're also online at reason.com. If you want to give to donate to the Soho Forum, give to reason.com, and we pass it through to them. We're a 501c3, so all your donations are tax deductible to the fullest extent of the law. And if you work that a little bit, you can probably get it even over more than the fullest extent of the law. But mostly what Reason is happy to help the Smith Family Foundation and Gene put together the Soho Forum is because we need really good, high-quality debates that are civil in tone but deep in knowledge about the most important issues of the day. Tonight's is a great example of that. You guys, how many of you have been here before? Okay, you know, with half, maybe more. You know, that's great. Keep coming back because you're helping to build a community of people who are knowledgeable and really bringing something new and different and smart to public debates like the Soho Forum. Thank you for coming out. Read Reason, go to reason.com, and take it away, Gene, and the Soho Forum.
Thank you, Nick. The Soho Forum has a twofold mission. The first is to hold debates of interest, hopefully not just to libertarians, but to anyone with any intellectual interest in social, political, and philosophical issues. But our second mission is to help form a community, and that's what our after parties are for. We have been now for the past few years holding those after parties at the loft apartment that I share with my wife, Hisako. And if you've bought a ticket to the after party, please come. If you haven't bought a ticket, come anyway, but please press the donate button on the Soho Forum website tomorrow morning to make up for your lapse. And again, that is tax deductible. Now for the main event, the resolution again reads, the government should offer to all Americans a health insurance plan that would compete with private insurance plans. Here to defend the resolution, Professor Jacob Hacker. Professor Hacker, please come to the stage. Here to oppose the resolution, David Goldhill. David, please come to the stage. Okay, Lucas, please close the voting. Jacob, you have 15 minutes to defend the resolution. Take it away, Jacob.
Thank you, Gene. Let me start my timer here.
Gotta respect him.
All right. So this is a daunting task to speak for just 15 minutes about this vast topic. And whenever I'm in a position like this, I'm reminded of an evaluation I received when I was a new assistant professor at Yale. And it began with great promise. It said, Professor Hacker, if I had just 15 minutes to live, I'd want to spend in your class. Because that way it would seem like an hour. So, yeah. Okay, so I will try to make this seem like 15 minutes. I do want to use a few of my valuable minutes to thank people. I want to thank Gene. I want to thank Lucas. I want to thank David. I want to thank those of you who came here at my invitation. You could call them my plants, I guess. But I understand David has a few in the audience as well. I want to thank my wonderful young research assistants, Lucas, Bronwyn, and Jack, for their help, and my daughter, Ava, especially, and her partner, Sylvan, for coming out here tonight. And then I want to thank all of you. It's really a measure of your commitment to public discussion that you're willing to spend an evening in New York City listening to David and me talk about the complex mechanics of health policy. Now, I fear this may not be the friendliest crowd, given the libertarian leanings of this organization, but I do have a quote from Murray Rothbard, a famous one. If you wish to know how libertarians regard the state and any of its acts, simply think of the state as a criminal band, and all the libertarian attitudes will logically fall into place. And I just want to say, I'm not a libertarian, and I feel that way right now, so don't worry about it. okay, and I also want to just acknowledge up front the tragic loss of David's father that motivated his writing his important book. I lost both my parents in the last 3 years, my mom just this fall, and I can't imagine, or now I can, how hard that is. So David's work has called attention to some of the most pressing problems in American healthcare. Prices are too high, healthcare is too often inaccessible, and preventable deaths occur far too frequently. I share his dismay and his sense of urgency. I've been working on this issue for more than 30 years as a political scientist and policy expert. And what I want to argue tonight, as the resolution says, is that I think that providing a public insurance plan available to all Americans who don't have secure coverage elsewhere is a way for us to address some of these problems. Now, I've been called the father of the public option. I'm feeling now, after 25 years of advocating this, almost the grandfather of the public option. But actually, the original phrase I used when I introduced the idea was public plan choice. And that's a really important aspect of the idea. This is not Medicare for all. I joke sometimes that it is Medicare for more. More Americans, younger Americans who balance out Medicare's risk pool, who are more familiar with and capable of benefiting from coordinated care, like the care I get from my little New Haven HMO, the Yale Health Plan, and importantly, who will press for Medicare to be improved and strengthened over time, not just for the aged, but for a broad cross-section of Americans. And I just want to also say that this is not necessarily the plan I'd advocate if we were starting from scratch. But we can't start from scratch. Countries have to build on what they have. In my work, I've called this path dependence. Where you go depends on where you've been. So the question is how we build on what we have in a way that can foster fundamental change over time, because we desperately need such change. Now, given the unique traditions and trajectories of American healthcare, that providing that choice of a public insurance plan can do much to improve our troubled system. At a basic level, it can improve value in our system because Medicare is able to bargain for much, much lower prices. Prices roughly 40 to 50% of what private insurance pays. This has allowed its cost to grow more slowly than private insurance, even though it covers a high need population. The public option that I advocate would allow millions of younger Americans to buy into a new part of Medicare. Now, this is a very popular program, right? It is a foundation stone of the American social contract, and it has gotten much better since the passage of the ACA. The ACA lowered Medicare's payments to providers, tried to rein in excess payments to private health plans that provide coverage, to about half of Medicare beneficiaries, encouraged innovation through alternative payment models. And as a result, Medicare's cost plummeted from 7% to 1.9% compared to that preceding decade. And one measure of this success is that the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund that funds Part A of Medicare, which was projected to be depleted by 2017 when the ACA passed, is today projected to be solvent until 2036. And Medicare, improved in other ways too. The burden of prescription drug prices was lowered. Preventive services were expanded. Hospice care became much more common, the kind of hospice care that allowed my mom to die at home rather than in a hospital. Just to give an example, annual wellness visits for Medicare beneficiaries not living in institutions increased from 8% to 60% since the ACA's passage. Now, I'm not going to pretend that Medicare doesn't need a lot more improvement, but it's a very important point in favor of a public option that Medicare is a popular, familiar, and simple program to many Americans. 80%, 82%, I think, view it favorably. And among Americans who use Medicare, 91% give it a good or excellent rating, which is 20 points higher than the average for private insurance. Given how hard it has been to overcome public fears in reforming healthcare, this is the foundation to build on. Again, people choose whether to buy into this new part of Medicare. Within Medicare, they choose between public and private plans. That dynamic of meaningful consumer choice imbues the public option with unique strengths in the American healthcare ecosystem. I often talk about these strengths as the three B's of the public option: backup, benchmark, and backstop. As a backup, the public option is a high-quality plan available on the same terms in all areas of the country. It guarantees healthcare is available for all citizens. And this is not just an idea supported by progressives like me. In The Road to Serfdom, Hayek writes, "There is no reason why, in a society which has reached the general level of wealth ours has," and remember he's writing right after World War II, "the state should not help to organize a comprehensive system of social insurance in providing for those common hazards of life against which few can make adequate provisions." Why would Hayek, of all thinkers, say this? Why a comprehensive system? For one, having basic economic security is essential to participating in the market. We know the problems that are caused by our employment-based system, people being locked into jobs because they need coverage or are afraid of losing certain providers. But more important, people need a basic foundation of security to take advantage of the dynamism of the market and to invest in the future. So it's really sad that 16 million Americans are projected to lose coverage under the recently passed budget bill. There is also the problem of cost shifting. If we do not cover everyone, right, the cost of the care that they receive that they can't pay for are shifted to those with insurance, and we all pay the price. Public plan choice emphasizes the importance of giving consumers not endless choices, but meaningful choices, the kind of choices among health plans, among health systems, that consumers are best equipped to make with the information necessary to make them. Markets work splendidly in many parts of our economy, but in the case of healthcare, they do fall short. Healthcare is not an oil change. You don't know when you'll need it. And when you do need it, you may not have the expertise to make an informed choice. There's a reason that a doctor studies medicines for years before writing the first prescription. We can be better informed. We can make meaningful choices, but we need both the protection of insurance and the expertise of medical experts. Since David wrote his important book, there's been a huge amount of research on whether consumers required to pay the cost of care out of pocket are good at choosing high-value care. And the verdict is in. They are not. Americans follow the recommendations of their doctor even when cheaper care is available on the market. It's why studies show that people seeking MRIs for their lower limbs drive by six less expensive providers between home and where they end up getting this highly standardized service. It's why one set of employees at a high-wage, high-education company were switched into high-deductible plans, according to a 2017 study, and reduced both potentially valuable care and potentially wasteful care. It's why a 2021 study showed that people who were made to pay more of their drug costs, Medicare beneficiaries, cut back on necessary drugs, and this hurt their health. So there's a place for informing information and choice. But if hitting patients on the head with higher costs was the answer, we would have lower costs than the rest of the world. not radically higher costs, because people pay more out of pocket here than in any rich democracy. Instead, a lot of what we do to improve healthcare will happen on the supply side, where doctors and hospitals have too much power, too often make mistakes, too often oversupply and undersupply care. Because healthcare markets are so concentrated and so prone to rent seeking, there has to be a countervailing power, a heavy, if you will, on the supply side too. That brings us to the second B. The public option is a benchmark. It sets the standard for the nation in terms of quality, breadth, simplicity, and affordability of care. Americans today lack meaningful choice in insurance markets. At least 95% of commercial insurance markets in the United States are highly concentrated, according to federal antitrust guidelines. And again, with a public option, Americans could still choose to purchase private plans available on the ACA exchanges. They would be able to choose within this public plan private alternatives, as in the current Medicare Advantage program. And then I should say that the reason that this Medicare Advantage system works is that because when these private plans are competing with Medicare, they have in the background Medicare's lower payment rates, which allows them to reap some of the bargaining power and savings that Medicare gets. Which brings us to that final B. The public option is also a backstop. It's effective at containing costs so that hospitals and insurers maintain reasonable prices for patients and don't restrict care. I think it's really worth reiterating that Medicare is paying 40 to 50% of what private insurers pay, that Medicare's prices have grown slower than private prices, than private insurance costs, that hospitals and doctors are enormously consolidated, and it is fanciful to think that either individual consumers or private insurers acting on their own can restructure the supply side of medicine in the ways necessary to bring down these costs. Now, you might worry that this will quell innovation, right? After all, Medicare is about to save about $10 billion over 10 years by bargaining for just 10 prescription drugs. But in fact, according to a recent study, Medicare is going to still be paying 3.9 times as much for those drugs than the norm in other rich countries. David has a nice metaphor in his book, The Island Versus the Mainland, meaning we shouldn't treat healthcare as an island unto itself, separate from the mainland of our economy. But we also shouldn't treat the United States like an island. The United States is the only OECD country that doesn't systematically negotiate prices. Peer nations have health costs 50% lower per capita than ours. We have lower, despite that, we have lower life expectancy. We have higher rates of preventable and treatable death. Avoidable mortality rates are going up in the United States, and almost all our peer nations, they are going down. These systems work. They are very diverse, and many, I'd argue, have as much as or more market freedom than we do, but they all ensure affordability, and they all have ways to hold down prices, improve value, primarily on the supply side. And let me close with a final important point. A public option wouldn't just pool risks across the young and the old, across all Americans. It would importantly pool risk across the young and the old to further contain costs. As I alluded to earlier, a huge problem in the United States has been the inherent generational conflict created by being the only country with national health insurance only for the elderly. If Medicare was a source of coverage for the young as well as the old, there would be much greater common interest and much stronger sense of shared fate and a much stronger program and system. So I'm at the end of my 15 minutes. I hope it seems like 15 minutes, so let me close with the most pithy of summaries. The public option is the best option.
Thank you. According to our timekeeper, David gets an extra minute and a half just to even up. So take it away, David. You get 16 and a half minutes to present your case.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming out tonight. sharing Jean Epstein's idea of what is summer fun. I want to thank Jacob for... did that use some of my minute and a half? I want to thank Jacob for being here tonight. It takes an unbelievable amount of courage to come in front of this group and argue that we should turn over more of our health care to a gang of criminals, as he suggested. And I want to thank Soho Forum for using what appears to be my bar mitzvah picture to publicize the event tonight. And then finally, and most importantly, I want to thank ChatGPT for what you're going to hear from it. I think I can say that Jacob and I share many, if not most, of the same goals. We both believe that healthcare should be good and available to all Americans at reasonable cost. We fundamentally disagree not just on how to get there, but on where we actually are today, both in the U.S. and around the world. There's a sentence in his one of his many, many books. I wrote one book. In his many books, many excellent books, called Great Risk Shift, that I think better than anything illustrates the difference between the way we see healthcare in America today. And I want to read the sentence. In 2015, medical expenses for the year totaled $33,269 for the costliest 10% of patients, $50,572 for the costliest 5%, and $112,395 for the costliest 1%. There is simply no way that families can finance expenses of this scale on their own. Insurance, like basic care, is not optional. That sentence and that idea is the foundation of the healthcare system in the United States and throughout most of the developed world. And if he said it in a conference of healthcare policy experts, every head in the room would be nodding. And my suspicion is every head in this room is kind of nodding. That sounds right. To update the numbers a little bit, obviously, these are almost 10 years old. The top 1% of spenders in a year spend $145,000 on care. That's a big number for any family. And that's why we have health insurance. Except it's wrong. Fundamentally, provably wrong. The average price of a family health insurance policy in the United States today is $27,000. If you have an average income job, the amount you will pour into Medicaid and Medicare from taxes on that job that your employer will pour in, an additional 10 grand. Think of this statement. There is simply no way that families can finance expenses of this scale on their own. So, every 4 years, the average income person pours into our healthcare system enough to pay for that 1% number, that $140,000 number. The big problem in healthcare policy is that things that were true when we spent 4% of GDP on healthcare are no longer true as we approach 20%. And that most of our assumptions about how healthcare works, most of the rhetoric, most of the argument, was never updated. Now, if you're putting up the top 1% spending every 4 years of your working career, that isn't insurance. It may be loan sharking, but it's not insurance. If you have to, in your homeowner's premiums, every 4 years, pay for the total cost of your house, that isn't insurance. A meaningful amount of what we call healthcare reform has been to maintain what I call the great illusion of healthcare, that somebody else is paying for your healthcare, but nobody else is paying for your healthcare. If you're going to spend 18% of GDP a year on healthcare, the money is going to have to come from everybody all the time. And then worse, if you're going to take that money when it comes in and you're going to spend a massive amount of it on intermediaries, on administration, on bureaucracy, on waste, on level of skimmer that exists only because you've insisted this system look like insurance, what's going to happen is what actually is the case in America today, which is the average family doesn't come close to getting back the million plus they put into the healthcare system over their lifetime. Not close. This is literally the opposite of insurance. And it persists because of really smart, clever ideas, like the public option, that keep the illusion going. Think of the political rhetoric around healthcare. We're taking from wealthy people and giving it to poor people. Maybe at 4% of GDP, but let's take Mr. Mamdani seriously and get rid of billionaires. I think he means just taking their money. If we took all of the money owned by billionaires in this country, we would pay for 15 months of healthcare, and then we'd be out of billionaires to help us pay for it. You think this system is somehow egalitarian? What do you think a $27,000 premium means to an employer when the employee makes $500,000 a year? It means almost nothing. And about 100 grand a year. It's a big part of their compensation. 50? 30? This system is massively regressive. It does the opposite of what its architects think. It imposes these enormous costs on having a job, which for 20 years was the major cause of reducing wage growth among the bottom 50% in our country. Let me tell you how bad it is. We present and still argue about healthcare as if it's some sort of great social benefit. Well, it's now 50x what we pay in cash welfare. What we're basically saying to the less fortunate is, we'll support you as a society, but only if you spend the money on healthcare. It's the worst kind of industrial policy there is. The United States this year, the United States governments, state and federal, will spend close to $2.5 trillion on healthcare programs. Let's do a thought experiment. If we spent nothing, we could give $30,000 to 50% of American households every year forever. We have a healthier country? Of course. What's the number one determination of health? Disposable income. Access to healthcare is way down the list. We started from the right place. But what we missed is that things change. And the way to keep the health insurance working is not yet more magical financial engineering. It's to understand that things change. Let me give you an example of things changing. When Jacob first started public choice option, I still think of it as public option. So I'm calling you the father of public option. The idea was a classic, right? Private insurers don't represent the interests of people. They represent the interests of profit. Let's compete with them with a public option. The problem is, since then, everything has changed. The evil insurers are no longer in the insurance business. The biggest insurers in the country, the five biggest, earn 60% of their revenue from managing public programs for Medicare and Medicaid. Close to 70% of American workers aren't insured by health insurers. They're insured by their employer. The health insurer is just the administrator. There are gigantic health insurance companies, Humana, Centene, Molina, that essentially do no private business. In those roughly 20 years since Jacob first proposed his idea, we eliminated health insurance in the sense that he was thinking about it, pooling risk, taking, those are terrible businesses. What health insurers do now is they administer government contracts and they game them. The most successful ones, like United Healthcare, have gamed, this complex, but essentially have gamed the Obamacare limits on profitability. Others game the star ratings in Medicare. Others game their state Medicaid programs. Almost all Medicaid is now administered through these formerly evil insurer companies. The interesting thing is if we adopted Jacob's idea now, not only would we have yet another leg of a complex system that prevents us from seeing what it really is, we'd have nobody to administer it. There is no public administration anymore. Medicare administers less than half of its money, and that number's going down fast. It's just a totally different world. I'm a businessman. I'm not an academic. I'm not a politician. So when I find myself in a hole, I do two things that neither of those do. The first thing I do is I stop digging. And the second thing is I ask, why am I in a hole? Last summer, I had a couple of heart valves replaced, which is not quite as much fun as they tell you. But here's the interesting thing. The heart valve replacement was first successfully done just before the passage of Medicare and Medicaid. We do about 100,000 of them a year now, and they're regarded as relatively routine, unless, of course, you're the patient. What struck me as I was looking at it is in the roughly 60 years that we've been doing heart valve replacement, there's been more than one valve, new valve, created. There's several hundred new valves over that time. It's all about innovation. It's all about change. I asked ChatGPT, what was treatable today that wasn't treatable in 1965? The list is extraordinary. I'd read it to you, but I just got the five notice. I was going to read it to you. But it really matters. Now, in traditional healthcare terms, what people think is, wow, I get it. All those new treatments must have added to the cost of care. That's why healthcare's gotten more expensive. But it's not. The reason healthcare's gotten more expensive is that people like me now aren't going to drop dead of a failed heart valve. We're going to live a lot longer. We're going to have the chronic conditions and the late in life diseases that define long, healthy lives. And that's the problem with the insurance system. There's no way to insure against good things. And the healthcare system has a lot of good things. I've been very, very critical of the healthcare system, and I am very critical of it. But the problem it has, fundamentally, is not that healthcare isn't good. It's not that innovation hasn't changed things. I mean, weirdly, our politics of it, we spend all the time arguing over access and none of the time thinking about what really matters. What really matters, of course, is what we're next able to fix and cure. Much more important than access. And the reason there is no healthcare system in the world other than America's, which drives all of this change and all of this innovation. We built, here and everywhere on Earth, a healthcare system on a flawed premise, that you could insure it, but you can't. So what else do you do? How do we take care of that? Well, first of all, let's recognize, even before we add a public option to Medicare and Medicaid and Obamacare subsidies and the VA and all the rest, that it's going to be complex. Healthcare right now has almost 200,000 individual billable services. It's going to be complicated. On the mainland, there is only one way to deal with complexity, and that's markets and competition. Everything we have done in healthcare policy, in part to maintain your illusion that somebody else paid for your care, and that it didn't come out of your salary and didn't come out of your taxes, there was some magic person that stepped in and paid it, has reduced competition, has reduced market play. And so we're in this weird position now where we say, well, markets can't work in healthcare because there are no markets in healthcare. There are no markets in healthcare because we've done things like, say, Medicare prices have to be lower than other prices. By the way, Medicare doesn't negotiate for lower prices. They statutorily require that you charge nobody less. That's kept prices up, not driven them down. Preventing providers from discounting to others is not a way to drive lower prices. We missed an enormous opportunity in the previous 20 years. In the previous 20 years, hospital occupancy rates declined to 60%. Doctors' salaries remained flat. All the big drugs went generic, and almost all major treatments were drug-driven, not procedure-driven, which is important because drugs have almost zero marginal cost. We have a massively data-rich industry, which would benefit enormously from an intelligent application of IT. Every other industry like that in the world saw price declines over those 20 years. What did the healthcare industry see? Price increases. How? Why? Because they weren't selling to a customer that cared about prices, us. This is how we actually assure health security, is by taking advantage of technology, not to add to the cost base, but to use the costs that are driven down to drive down prices. Unfortunately, the only way to do that is to make the island look more like the mainland, and I know that's scary. We've seen tons of examples of it. My company, Sesame, is an example of what open markets do to prices. But by the way, so are these GLP-1s, which prices have declined by 65% in the last year because insurers refuse to cover them. They'll decline another 65% next year. We don't need another level of prices. We don't need another level of payment complexity. What we need is to gradually reverse the flood, keep more healthcare resources with individuals, finance more of normal healthcare out of our pocket, and instead of regulating to prevent markets and prevent competition, regulating to drive it wherever we can. And if we get to later, I can describe what some of those are. But the last thing we need to do, the most important thing we can do right now, take back their shovels. No more digging. Thank you.
Prime Minister rebuttal. Take it away, Jacob.
All right. Well, first, just let me say what a pleasure and privilege it is to be here, and what a challenge it is to discuss these complex issues relatively late. Relatively late into the evening, and with a very different perspective on the table. So, like, I want to just reiterate. I think that David and I agree that there's much wrong with American healthcare and much that's wonderful about it, but we differ not just on what's desirable, but what's realistic. We have a system with exorbitantly high costs because we have exorbitantly high prices, and I don't know how Medicare having much lower prices is the problem for the system that David alluded to, and because he knows as well as I do that efficient hospitals make money on Medicare patients. So it's not that it's not a story of cost shifting, and it's just not realistic. This idea that somehow the fact that we, again, our healthcare costs are so much higher than in other rich democracies who are using an insurance model that has a basic level of security for everyone, because these exorbitantly high levels of costs, right, mean that we as a society are paying way more than we should be individually, per capita, regardless of how distributed, right, that we have no dispute on that. But I can tell you that there are two reasons why people want to have insurance protection. And these are good reasons, right? One is security against devastating losses, right? And the other, and you know, that top 1% number is an average, right? We know what the extremes are. I've seen the extremes in the care that my mother received with pancreatic cancer. And I know that we could not have paid for that care without insurance. And I know David supports catastrophic coverage, so I want to be clear. But I just want to say, why do we need insurance? Why do we want it? So the other thing is that much of the value is going to be driven by changes on the supply side, right? There are enormous opportunities, I think, for competition. I think competition among insurance plans could be extremely valuable. I think that there are internal markets that could be extremely valuable. But I think we should recognize that that if we give up the possibility of using the bargaining power and, or shall I say, the price-setting power of the federal government, we're going to be giving up the opportunity to restructure healthcare in a way that is extraordinarily valuable and that is realistic because it can build on this familiar foundation. I come back to this fact that there, since the RAND health insurance experiment of the 1970s, around when I was born, there have been study after study. Healthcare has not changed in that one fundamental way, that what RAND found was that people did not distinguish between high value and low value care. And what we've seen in recent studies is that people are foregoing care. That high wage, high educated company where health savings accounts, a high deductible plan was adopted, these people did not, after 2 years do a good job of choosing the highest quality and high value care. And so the last thing that I want to emphasize again is that the public option is an important addition to this system, not because it adds great layers of complexity on top of the existing system, because it adds a lot of actually simplicity, right? My view and my original plan was that over time we would move away from reliance on Medicaid, state-level programs, and all Americans who did not get coverage through their employers would get coverage through a public option with a choice of public and private plans within it. And importantly, another thing to say is this is like such an important point, right, is that part of the argument was that for employers in concentrated insurance markets, they might want to buy insurance for their workers through this public option. So we need to compare the real system we have today with real alternatives, not with idealized visions. We have to build on what we have in a way that makes fundamental change possible over time. The public option is a pragmatic reform that makes our markets work better by giving people the security they need to take risks in a volatile, dynamic, and yes, increasingly prosperous world, and by lessening the huge opportunity costs of the most expensive healthcare system in the world. We need a system that contains costs while offering a baseline level of care that enables Americans to lead more dignified lives, that allows them to be healthier and, yes, freer in our capitalist economy. Thanks.
Thank you. 5 minutes. 5 minutes of rebuttal. David, please take it away.
So I agree with Jacob that we need health insurance. Same way we need homeowners insurance and auto insurance. Homeowners insurance doesn't cover your furniture going out of style. It doesn't cover your boiler running out. There's a role for insurance. But if you're going to run the entire healthcare economy through a form of finance that is completely unsuitable for most goods and services, that pretends that every positive healthcare interaction is an insurance claim with all the extraordinary expense, then you're going to put a lot more into the system than you take out. That's what happened. It doesn't matter what the theory was. It doesn't matter what we were hoping. That's what happened. Medicare does not bargain for lower prices. Medicare is one of the great profit opportunities for everybody. Why? Because it thinks it can discover prices without competition by saying, we will pay the lower prices. Well, guess what? If you've ever worked in an actual business, you know the lowest price is what you're willing to charge, and there's no way on earth Medicare's ever gotten close to that. What it's done is set a floor for the extraordinarily high prices we pay. And Jacob's right, we do pay extraordinarily high prices. He's just wrong as to why. The reason we pay extraordinarily high prices is because the people who've run healthcare policy don't understand the role of consumers on the mainland. They think what happens is you go into Walmart and you say, okay, this toothpaste, tell me about the components of cost so I can determine if the price is right. In a consumer-driven economy, in every industry other than the way healthcare experts talk about it, consumers do no work. Sellers chase buyers. And with all respect, you gave away the ghost when you said, oh, we'll improve price on the supply side. You never improve price on the supply side, except by forcing supply to chase the customer. The insurance system has done the exact opposite. And that is why, despite the fact that the marginal cost of providing care, in terms of resource use, the things that would matter in any other industry, are in fact declining, and are about to rapidly decline with the impact of AI and remote technologies and virtual technologies, you won't actually see a price decline. You know, I mentioned that the last 20 years were a terribly missed opportunity. Here's the major reason they were. American hospitals, who are the business partner of Medicare, and I know this because I've been working in hospital safety issues ever since my dad died, American hospitals have convinced the American government of both parties that if they could become more efficient, prices would decline. So both parties allowed hospitals to buy medical practices, to buy other hospitals. So the price of healthcare services in the United States depends on what city you live in. If you live in a city that has one or two consolidated medical systems, guess what? Prices are higher. But what about the efficiency on the supply side? Isn't that what they said? They've got leverage. It turns out that's what drives prices, not some theoretical efficiency. Healthcare is a low marginal cost business. It is a high price business because of the way we've chosen to pay for it. Let me spend a second talking about the rest of the world, because before the collapse of the NHS, this was the big argument against it. No one else is doing it, everyone's better. This is something I know from my previous life in the entertainment business. There's only one healthcare system in the world. It's ours. We make the movies. Everybody else is just a distributor. 75% of the profit on healthcare innovation comes from the American market, which means of the 138 Alzheimer drugs that now exist in trials, all of them, every single one of them, are being developed to make their money in the American market and then make tiny amounts elsewhere. The American healthcare market is 40% of the world market, bigger than any other industry, the dominance of any other industry. The rest of the world has done this sort of cute thing, which is, oh, let us know which ones won, and we'll restrict the price we pay. What everybody else on Earth has that the United States doesn't is the United States. And if we adopted any of these systems, we would be giving up our future, the world's future, for our present price. It's unsustainable. Unfortunately, healthcare is NATO. It's a second NATO. There may be ways to address it, but everybody else is just a film distributor. We're making the movies.
Yeah. Thank you, David. We now go to the Q&A portion of the evening. I want to exercise moderator's prerogative first and ask each a question. David, you have alluded to just now your idea that essentially the U.S. Healthcare system subsidizes the rest of the world, because I believe you claim that the innovative drugs, the innovative implements, and the innovative procedures all come from the U.S. and support the other programs. First of all, if that's the case, then isn't that something you like about the healthcare system? But I guess if that's the case, are you claiming that if we go in Jacob's direction, then all of that innovation that supports the rest of the system will be throttled?
Yeah, let me be clear. Innovation.
Mike.
No, I'm Jacob.
Yeah.
That was last month's debate.
And anything for a joke, David Goldhill. Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
You invited me. Let me be clear on something. Innovation in healthcare is done all over the world, literally everywhere. There are incredibly smart people working everywhere. If you look at how they raise capital, their business models are all identical. We will make 50 to 90% of our profit in the American market, and then we'll sell for whatever we can in other places. By the way, this is true of innovation done in the UK. There's another point that's subtle, which is we think this is just about drugs, but it's not. One of the features of the American market that's unusual is the fact that it's unregulated except for payment, which means that hospitals and doctors compete vigorously on anything other than price. So you have two things going on. You have the profit opportunity in America and the chance to introduce something new in America. If you're running a doctor's practice and the guy across the street buys some new device, you gotta have it too. That's why robotic surgery was almost exclusively American forever, even though we didn't invent the technology. The reason this matters is because what it lets the rest of the world do is say, you know what, and health economists love this, we're going to pay for innovation too, but only on a fair return, i.e. a lower price. Because of those 138 Alzheimer trials, 95% are going to fail, and people are going to lose all of their money. So what the Europeans mostly do is equivalent to saying, if you win the lottery, we determine what a fair return is. It seems like 15% is a fair return on a winning lottery ticket. Needless to say, no one buys a lottery ticket for that lottery. But they're able to get away with it in healthcare because their markets are tiny. America's 40% of world healthcare spend. The UK's 4%. If you can get 75% of your profit in America, you can price almost anything you want anywhere else on Earth. The Europeans have very cleverly stepped into this and have used it to control prices of innovation and not pay for failure. That's why their systems are cheap. They're also able to put most doctors and hospitals on budgets, another thing we don't do. America's the only, we talk about the lack of American generosity. We're the only system that does this as an entitlement. There's no budget. In theory, whatever you need, you can get. No one else does that. It's a trick, in other words. It's not really they're paying lower prices. We're subsidizing them. And the amount, if you really look through it, is trillions of dollars.
Are you saying then that if Jacob's plan were implemented, that innovation would be throttled?
No. In fact, if Jacob's plan's implemented, we'd have more innovation because Jacob's plan, like all other attempts to make the insurance system look real, simply pushes up prices. Higher the prices, the more the innovation. What we don't have in this country is a proper way to balance cost-saving innovation versus therapeutic innovation. So, as I said, hospitals and doctors compete on being better. They never compete on price. What we need for the system to work is to compete on both. Jacob's system will not hurt innovation unless he imposes the type of price controls that the systems he says he admires use, but I don't think he was saying he would do that. America will continue to be the only country that drives profits and innovation in the world.
Comment from you, Jacob, about that question and answer.
Do I need to turn this on? No. Okay. So first of all, I love this agreement here. So because I think we both agree that just paying very high prices is an enormously inefficient way to encourage innovation. In part because, and this gets us beyond some of the very specific things we've talked about, there's just lots of ways to make more money by doing and capture more rents. You know, rent seeking is a huge part of the American healthcare system by doing dumb stuff, right? Like patent hopping, lawsuits, and the like. And there's really good work being done about how to encourage innovation. And we do a lot of, I think, the fundamental work through our R&D expenditures, which is something that I've written about in my work on why the U.S., how the U.S. Helps support a dynamic capitalist economy. And it's a real shame, I think, that we're not, that we're cutting back on that investment. But I do think it's really important to encourage innovation, and I think a lot of that goes beyond insurance or whatever prices a public option would pay. It's also, I think, really important to recognize that, you know, however big of a part of the healthcare economy these other countries are, that this basic combination of universal insurance and some system for trying to restrain costs has produced much, much lower costs, dramatically lower costs, right? Incomparably lower costs. There is no way that you can come up with a number from American innovation that's somehow going to fill that gap, and much better health outcomes. And I agree with David that a lot of what makes for good health is not what healthcare or health insurance, acute healthcare or health insurance provides. And so I think it's extremely important to think about how are you improving health through the insurance model and through other interventions. But to me, the crucial thing I really want to emphasize here is that in the real world that we're in, this dysfunctional system we're in, it's absolutely, we're leaving an enormous amount of money on the table and an enormous amount of better health on the table by not harnessing
more effectively the ability of the public sector to encourage higher quality care. There are very strong examples I talked about. And it's important to, it's important that I'm arguing that if you create a broader public insurance program that is more of a focal point for coverage, more of a heavy in the market, that you're going to be able to do more of that, which is, I think, a really important part of the story. But it's not the only part. And last thing I would just say is I think there's a huge role for private insurers, as I've said, for employers, for innovators, and I think there are places where prices do work, right? But like Hayek, I think we need to have a comprehensive system of social insurance with a basic foundation of security, and we don't have that today.
Challenging question for you, Jacob. The only thing that most of us know is that longevity, life expectancy, has been declining. To what extent would you feel the healthcare system is responsible for it or not?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's really one of the grave challenges we face as a nation. As I pointed out, right, avoidable mortality has been rising in the U.S., falling in other countries. The original work about this, you know, probably Angus Deaton and Ann Case did this work, which sort of emphasized that it was really focused on Americans without a college degree. But what a lot of the additional research has shown is this is like a very broad-based problem. Now, again, I don't think I would put my primary emphasis on insurance in this story, but I do think it's a really important part of insurance is and the public option would be a very important part of addressing this challenge, right, alongside other interventions. And so I would say, A, it makes a difference whether people have insurance in the first place, right? It makes a difference for their financial security and it makes a difference for their health. B, right, that we need to see a much different model of care. I do think that it's a good thing that, you know, Medicare has moved towards annual wellness visits, but like in my original proposal, and in the work, in the advocacy I've done, I think it's clear that we need to have much more coordination of care and that a much more heavier, greater emphasis on a wide range of providers. My mom was a nurse and she delivered babies, which is like the happiest part of the healthcare system to work in. And I always felt as if it was just striking how poorly utilized nurses were in the system, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. So there's a lot of ways in which I think we could deliver care better. And then finally, I just think there's no question that this is a societal-wide challenge that we need to address. I mean, David and I think, agree that it's not the most efficient way to deal with fundamental inequality in our society to just spend more and more dollars on health care and health insurance, right? And I think this is like a... We disagree pretty fundamentally about how you get there, but there's this common belief, right? There's an enormous opportunity cost here. There's a lot of other things that we should be doing as a society to make to tackle inequality, to encourage innovation, to make sure people are well-educated, and all that. But I believe strongly that this is a realistic path towards making those resources available and creating the kind of common cohesive system that will allow people to make some of those more difficult trade-offs with their healthcare dollars.
Comment from you, David, on the question and Jacob's answer.
You know, I appreciate where Jacob is coming from. This is the system we have. This is sort of the system everyone else has, different in a couple other ways. I don't know. I'm not willing to risk changing it. Let's continue to tinker around the edges. Okay. What will it take? So in 1965, when we passed Medicare and Medicaid, which are the two most important pieces of legislation in the healthcare system, the few surveys we did showed somewhere between 15 and 20% of the population said they had trouble paying for their own healthcare. We spent $34 trillion since then. Surveys say somewhere between 15 and 20% of the people have trouble paying for their healthcare. We're going to spend another $30 to $40 trillion in the next decade. Interestingly, we just had this massive political argument over whether $1 trillion one way or another meant fiscal responsibility or mass death. It's absurd. It's a failure. There is no insurance system in which you put $1.5 million in the hope that, or the thrill that someone's going to pay $200,000
when you need heart valve surgery. There's in infinite numbers of ways to get money to you at that point in your life more cheaply. We have an economy. A lot of it is insanely complicated. Somehow during the same period of time we had Medicare and Medicaid, they figured out how to get a supercomputer in everybody's pocket for under $1,000. None of us have PhDs in computer science. They sold them to us. You got to decide what you want in 21st century healthcare. When these insurance systems were created here and everywhere else, healthcare could do very little good. Let's be candid. There are only a few conditions that healthcare really helped. Not that they weren't trying. Suddenly, that's changing. This system wasn't designed for success. It doesn't work when healthcare is actually successful. It's much more fun to tinker around the edges and argue about the ways that Medicare can drive quality. You live in New York City. I don't know how many of you voluntarily go to public hospitals instead of private hospitals. I'm very critical of the private hospitals. I still go to the private hospitals. I haven't seen any evidence of Medicare using its market power to drive quality or price or anything. And you want to talk about path dependence. The U.S. government is great at a lot of things, but there's not a lot of areas where it drives great value and great quality. That's not what we rely on it for, and we don't need it to do that. What we need it to do is to bring price competition to healthcare now. And the reason is because there's a world in which AI and remote technologies and virtual technologies and personalization allowed by genetic knowledge drive down the cost and improve the quality of healthcare beyond our imagination. And there's another world, which we've lived in for the last 65 years, where all they do is add another level of cost. If you're a hospital thinking about using AI, why would you use it to reduce prices? Why not use it the same way you used robotic surgery, telemedicine? Why not use it the same way you use drugs going generic? To just argue you needed another reimbursement. We've been through this play. It's how we got here. We're not stuck with a mid-20th century healthcare system. The great thing about moving to a more normal system is you can do it gradually. You don't need to suddenly throw everything out. Emphasize competition and markets and regulation. Reverse some of the flood of money that we're all putting into the system back to us. Maybe start with the people who get Medicaid. Trust me, they'd rather have the cash.
Okay, you're summarizing, David. Thank you for that. You will both have the opportunity to ask each other a question, but I want to give at least several people in the audience their chance to start asking questions. Please ask your question as a question. No need to identify yourself. What's your question, sir?
Thank you both for being here. My question's for Mr. Goldhill. You both identified a lot of issues with the healthcare system, and I appreciate that. The thing that appeals to me about Mr. Hacker's plan is that it seems eminently possible and practical in the next 5 to 10 years, just in terms of achieving it. You kind of just answered this in your last response, but I'd like to press you on what you think some practical implementation of an improvement for the healthcare system would look like under your plan or ideas.
Thank you for that. I did, but let me just give you a couple of little things, tiny things that you could do tomorrow. Medicare, apparently in its effort to drive prices, will pay more for the same service provided in a hospital than in any other location, even if you can do it in any location. That's anti-competitive. That discourages people from offering lower prices, so they don't. We now have very high deductible plans, the rule. By the way, not just in private insurance, but also on the Obamacare exchanges, and amazingly enough now on Medicare. And yet, Medicare aside, all of those plans, even though you're spending your own money on a deductible, are allowed to restrict your spend to their network. Nobody has any incentive to compete for your business. That was the whole point of high deductible plans. I could go on, but the fundamental thing is to keep this system going, to keep the illusion going.
What we have is lots of different prices for the same service, organized by the state. There's a Medicaid price, there's a Medicare price, there's a private insurance price, there's a VA price, there is a with subsidy deductible, without subsidy deductible, on and on and on and on. That's why there's no competition. There are an innumerable number of ways, and I'm not going to waste everyone's time going through that, those are just a few examples, in which instead of saying, how do I keep this grand illusion going? How do I convince you all someone else is paying for your care? What I do with regulation is I say, how do I encourage competition on price everywhere I can? How do I make it so that somebody in the healthcare system can make more money by cutting price, which is not the case today outside of a few of us, like my company, for example, but it's basically not seen in healthcare. I think you would be shocked how rapidly the genius of American capitalism would respond to that, as it does in everything else. And so that's what I'm calling for. I'm not calling for a radical overhaul. We shouldn't do one. We don't need to do one. If we do it at the margins, we'll all be sitting here saying, oh, wow, innovation can drive prices lower, not just higher in healthcare, sort of like in everything else.
Comment from you, Jacob, on the question and the answer.
Actually, I think we should get some more questions in the mix. I'd love to have some additional
next question.
People yeah. waiting.
Sure.
Question for both of you guys. One of the key points was regarding we need. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the questions was one of the key points was that we want consumers.
A little slower.
One of the key points was we want consumers to be involved in making decisions to drive down prices rather than having insurance companies pay. So my question is, could having more high deductible plans or a public option that is based on a high deductible plan be something that could drive down prices while also being acceptable politically in terms of providing social insurance?
Did you get that question?
I did. And it's good because it kind of falls.
Summarize the question.
The question is whether or not we could, there's more high deductible plans in the market. As David pointed out, Medicare actually has some holes in coverage that mean that it actually can impose a lot of cost on people. Most people historically have gotten supplemental insurance. One of the reasons why the private health plans that provide health insurance under Medicare Advantage to about half of Medicare beneficiaries have had the ability to grow their market share over time is that people are enrolling them because they want to have that kind of they want to have coverage against some of these out-of-pocket costs. The central question is basically like how much of a role should you have for cost sharing as the key for driving this? And I don't know if David and I disagree because I don't think that cost sharing the way it's structured today is going to be very good at encouraging people to select high quality care. There is, as I said, there's just lots of research on this by really excellent scholars using incredible real-world data sets, and including, you know, going back to this pioneering health insurance experiment that happened in the area I grew up in the Northwest, that shows that the cost sharing itself is just not very good at making that kind of discrimination. And so my favorite example of this is the lower limb MRI. So, you know, the people who are having MRIs in their lower limbs drive past six lower cost providers on the way to the one that that they're going to. And part of that is about networks. A lot of it is about the fact that we rely on doctors to know what is necessary when we are facing serious health problems. It's not just that sometimes we won't be able to make those decisions ourselves. That's an obvious problem. But it's also that we want to, ideally in partnership with our doctors, with our own ability to gain information and consult with others, that we want them to be our agents. And that's a fundamental feature of medical care. It is why it is a very different kind of market than many others. And the fact that we have to rely on providers, that we want to rely on providers, means that the incentives that they have are just fundamentally important. And those incentives come not from us price shopping. They come, or at least not primarily from us price shopping. They come from how you set up the supply side of the market. I don't know why saying that we can drive value on the supply side is a kind of upside down view. It's actually what we need to do in a lot of areas of our economy and historically have done, right? Making fundamental investments in research and development. How are we gonna get out of our housing crisis? It's like thinking about that in New York, the rent is too damn high. Just quickly, housing. It's like, it feels to me like blaming insurance for the problems of high healthcare prices is a bit like blaming mortgages for the problem of high housing prices. We know what the problem in housing is, right? It's on the one hand a lot of regulations that are pushed at the local level, but on the other hand, it's that we need to make like fundamental investments as a society to encourage affordable housing that is available broadly. And there's a lot of other areas of our economy in which that is true, and it just happens to be very true in healthcare, and a public option could help provide it.
Comment from you, David, on the question and the answer.
So ever since I started thinking about healthcare issues, I have been shocked how the things we simply know in the rest of the economy just never made it into healthcare economics. As if these things were just amazing. The RAND study that Jake's referred to a couple times is the classic misunderstanding of how consumer markets work. In consumer markets, consumers do no work. What makes them consumer markets is that sellers chase buyers. It's how the entire rest of the economy works. It's what drives price, it's what drives quality, it's what drives innovation. Only in healthcare do we say, oh, well, you know, it's gonna be a problem because consumers are gonna have to choose. When you have a normal consumer economy, providers are endlessly trying to convince you this is a great service at a great value, and they compete to do so. It's what drives prices down. Literally nothing else does. There is no price coming down because someone says, oh, you know, I don't need to sell at a lower price, but it didn't cost me anything to make this, so I just will. I do agree with Jacob that the way we've structured cost sharing is utterly useless for this. That was the point I made, is that we've given everybody high deductible plans and we've told them that nobody can compete for the business. Insane. Worst of both worlds. Medicare, by the way, we haven't just had some leakage in coverage. Because we've been desperately trying to keep the illusion going, the average out-of-pocket in Medicare now is $6,000 a year. One in every 10 Medicare beneficiaries is spending 50% of their income out of pocket on healthcare. This insurance system is collapsing here and everywhere else on earth. We can try to keep it going. Maybe there's a financial engineering idea. That's basically all a public option is, yet another financial engineering idea. But you cannot make expensive healthcare cheap for everybody through financial engineering. You are going to have to use the price system in healthcare like we do in everything else.
Can you comment on Jacob's point that medical care is different because doctors are experts and we are ignorant of medicine?
So all services are like that. Every single service is like that. The RAND study is this just crazy idea of, let's ask healthcare economists who apparently never have been shopping. They apparently have never used a lawyer. They apparently never used a hairdresser or an interior designer. Every service on earth. What's interesting about healthcare is that when I go to a lawyer, I rely on that lawyer's advice as to what legal service to buy. But one thing that moderates it is I'm paying for it. So if she says to me, you know, we need to sue everybody, I think, I don't know, I want to pay for that. In healthcare, we've done this crazy thing. We've said, well, since you're relying so heavily on a doctor's advice, we'll pay for it. Wait a minute. Doesn't that make the advice less competitive, less useful, less restricted? And one of the arguments people make as to why we consume so much healthcare is we've done this crazy thing, which is at point of sale, we say, the guy who's selling you the service is going to recommend you buy the service, and you don't need to pay for it. Sounds great for you. But for 330 million people, that's why you're all putting 1.5 million into the system.
Next question.
For Jacob in the affirmative, is there anything in this public option plan that you're envisioning that has that has eligibility requirements based on my employment and my employer? And for either Jacob or David, is there anything that can get my employer away from my health insurance business, you know?
Yeah, it's a great. I mean, look, I wrote a book on why we ended up with employment-based system and why we ended up with the only national health insurance program just for the aged. And the two are, of course, deeply interwoven. I think there are a lot of reasons why employers, as a rule, should not be the primary way you get health insurance. It's like piling on risk. You lose your job, then you risk losing your coverage. Your employer has incentives that are weird. Let's put it that way. So I'm very much, and I think a lot of people who've studied our system are very much of the view that we should be thinking about how to move ourselves away over time, away from employment-based coverage. Of course, the biggest thing that has stood in the way of reforming the system is the fear that people who have health insurance from their, particularly from their employer, that they'll lose their coverage. And so, there's a path-dependent problem there that I think we have to address. But I do think with the public option, essentially there were two elements to it in my original proposal, and I've thought about this a lot, and I think there are other ways you could do it. So in the original proposal, the idea was that employers could choose whether they wanted to provide insurance that met certain standards, and otherwise they would get to pay an amount that was proportional. This is really important, like proportional to wages and lower for small wage firms into the public option to help pay for that coverage. I also said, and I still believe, that there should be a way of having individual workers be able to opt out of that coverage and opt into the public option. There's challenges there, I grant you. I would not be averse to moving away from employment-based coverage. It's not synonymous with moving to a totally public system, right, for all the reasons we've talked about. But I do think it's really important to understand that we need to, as we move these costs, these prices out more into the open, right, that hidden cost that David says we all pay, right, and it's hidden in private employment-based premiums that are paid out of your lower wages, and they're hidden in tax subsidies for private health insurance. When you move away, you have to do it in a way that doesn't raise fear. So I think the one great thing about this is it like creates a process by which people can get out of private health insurance, I mean about private employment-based coverage, right? But it's a choice with the money flowing with them, right? And it will happen over time because there are some employers that actually do a pretty good job of this and they should keep doing it.
Comment from you, David, on the question.
I mean, look, we're in agreement on the principle that putting your healthcare system with employers was a terrible mistake and a terrible design. The difference, as in most of these things, would be, I think if something's terrible, you try to stop doing it. And making the system more complex entrenches it. It doesn't get us closer to the type of transparency and individualization it needs. It makes it harder to unwind. We're going to be unwinding this in the second half of the century. We can start.
I'm afraid this is going to have to be the final question. Take it away.
My question is for Dr. Hacker.
A little bit more into the mic.
Oh, can you hear me?
Okay.
So my question is, how would you address the enormous adverse incentives within our political system? And so to unpack my question just a little, when you look at past attempts to reform the system, either through PPACA or Medicare Modernization Act, there were things like mandated minimum coverage that resulted in an explosion of costs for small businesses and individuals that were purchasing in the cash market because of a single man had to buy maternity coverage, that sort of thing. Or the Medicare Modernization Act, donut hole. These types of things are inevitable consequences of all of the stakeholders trying to find a solution that everyone can vote on eventually. So how would you deal with these enormous adverse incentives, as I see it, that make really reform impossible?
Jacob.
Well, so there's two parts to the question, and I, one, I think I have an answer, and the second, I'm not sure, but I don't know that anybody has a great answer to. So on the first part, I think I have an idea for how we get from here to there, right? Of course, during the debate over the Affordable Care Act, the public option, a weaker version of it than I would like, was in the legislation but was stripped out in the Senate by my home state senator, Senator Joe Lieberman, who thankfully did like reverse constituency services and called me out in the New York Times, where he said I was against the compromise deal because Jacob Hacker was for it, which I thought was like just very strange, not because I'm an academic at Yale, but also because like if I had known that in advance, I would have been, you know, I would have been for some other things, like the Iraq War, say, or something. Anyway, but on the so that was a hard, that showed how hard it was, and that was a very narrow window. But I think, you know, we've seen that the public option has returned as like a very straightforward kind of center-left proposal, if you will, that is on the agenda, and I think is viable. I mean, I don't think, as I've said, I don't think Medicare for All is at all politically realistic, and simultaneously, I don't think, as we've seen, it's like really hard to move in the other direction as well. This was a really remarkable thing that 16 million Americans might lose insurance. Let's hope it doesn't happen. So I think that political challenge, the whole idea, like studying this healthcare system, figuring out what's possible, that's what I sort of spent all the time doing and designing the public option. But the second problem, and I'll just say quickly, is the political economy of Medicare, or the political economy of public health insurance more broadly, which is really challenging, right? You have a bunch of claimants, right? I just want to come back to this thing, like, there's, you know, this simple fact, which is a fact, is that Medicare's costs have grown more slowly, right, than private insurance costs for comparable services. It's grown dramatically slower since the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Medicare pays much less. Again, I am baffled by this argument that that Medicare's ability to get costs that are 50% of what private payers are paying is somehow at the root of our healthcare crisis, right? Like, to me, this is a sign that there is potential that is probably untapped, and potential to do other things with that bargaining power. But again, the political economy of doing that is very hard. And I think the only thing I can say in favor of this is, A, under the conditions in which this can happen, I think there's more chance that you can also take on these vested interests, and B, that having more Americans in this system actually does make it more likely that you're going to be defending the interests of those Americans and the fiscal interests of the federal government than if you don't have more Americans in it.
Comment from you, David, on the question and the answer.
So I think it's an excellent question. You know, if you read the famously 900 pages of the Affordable Care Act, I guarantee anyone in this audience can tell you who paid for each paragraph. You can't spend $2.5 trillion without dividing the money politically. It's unbelievably naive to say Medicare is driving lower prices when Medicare by law says you can't choose prices lower than us. That increases prices, it doesn't reduce prices. Anybody who wants to discount a price below Medicare has to refund to Medicare the difference on every patient they've ever seen. Think that drives prices lower? It's absurd, it's optics, it's not real. There's nothing in the healthcare system that's really driving down prices. Let me give you my single favorite statistic in healthcare, and you'll understand what I mean. The percentage of healthcare dollar in 1965 that went to hospitals, to physicians, and to drugs was roughly 37% to hospitals, 25% to physicians, 10% to drugs. It's 60 years later. Think of all the changes that occurred in the therapeutic part of healthcare, the breakthrough drugs, the collapse of the hospital business as we went from procedures that required 3-4 weeks of inpatient stay to overnight stay. Think of how doctors' incomes haven't moved. the percentages are identical today. Try to imagine any other industry in the last 60 years in which the split between, you name it, doesn't matter, manufacturer, labor, you know, one type of company, another. Imagine if the landline companies were getting their same percentage that they got in 1965. The television networks. Pick it. It doesn't matter. Car manufacturers. How is it possible that our most complex, most dynamic, most changing, fastest growing, most important industry has a completely flat share of distribution as to who gets paid over 60 years? Well, the reason is the healthcare economy isn't run by markets. It's not run by sellers chasing buyers. It's run by politicians. Who do you think they run it for? You think they run it for you? Do you think they try to keep this illusion going that they've found some way for everybody's health care to be paid by somebody else? Has it been worth it? $33 trillion, and 20% of us still have trouble paying for health care. At some point, maybe not tonight, we're going to say enough. And we've done it before in our history. It's not path dependency, sure. But the incredible thing about markets, unlike relying on politics or policy, I don't need legislation to be passed. I don't need some big reform movement. I don't need lobbyists. I don't need contributions. I just need at the margins. Let markets play. Let people spend some of their own money, because eventually they're going to want to spend more, and eventually markets will matter more. We're about to undergo a technological revolution in healthcare that is going to fundamentally change it. Do you want to keep a system that will convert that into high prices that cause more income inequality, lower wage growth among lower income people, and a further diversion of resources from the things that actually drive health just to more medical care? It is possible to do better, but you got to start. You can't be so intimidated by the fact that everybody's system on earth is collapsing, but it's all we have. When I did this debate years ago, it was the NHS. The NHS is done, right? The government just issued a report to fix it in 10 years. It's the exact same report that the conservative government issued 6 years ago, exact same way to fix it. They were going to fix it in 5 years. Didn't happen. It's done. All these systems are going to collapse. None of them make sense. America's always leading. Let's lead. Let's build a 21st century healthcare system. We can do it at the margins. And it will ultimately take over and bring this island back to the mainland.
Thank you, David. We now go to the summary portion of the evening, 5 minutes for each. Jacob, would you like to take the podium? Would you like to sit? Either way, 5 minutes, take it away.
All right. Well, first of all, I really regret that we didn't get a chance to get more questions. So I hope that you'll take Gene up on his kind offer to come to the after party and buttonhole David and me and ask your questions. So, and I apologize in addition for us being so long-winded that you weren't able to ask all your questions. So I'm going to keep my remarks short and simple, right? And I want to come back to the main arguments that I made earlier today. The public option is a way in which we can preserve choice, promote competition, and control costs. And we need it precisely because there are many ways in which healthcare is not a normal market. We need innovation. We need changes in structures, in healthcare system structures, like some of the ones that David proposes. But it's the solution ultimately lies in trying to figure out how to use the great purchasing power of government and encourage improvements in American health care. The public option does this because, as I said, it's a backup, it's a benchmark, and it's a backstop. It's a backup, it ensures access to high quality care for all Americans. It's a benchmark, it sets a national standard of quality for private insurers, which are enormously consolidated today. And it's a backstop, right, by bringing down prices with healthcare providers by pooling risk across all ages. I felt as if, in a lot of ways, I'm trying to counter a vision that is kind of conjured up out of a mythical vision of markets as they might operate in this realm. And the one question I wanted to ask David, and he's welcome to answer it if he wants in his 5 minutes, right, is what other mature, rich democracy has a system that does what he likes? And if he says the answer is no, then there might be a reason for that, right? There might be a reason for that in the way in which healthcare works. It is a market beset by not just market failures that we know well, but also by, of course, as he knows well, distortions that come from our political economy. And I just think it's really important to understand that it's not as if there are this doesn't exist in other areas of the market as well, right? And so to say that if we can somehow free American healthcare from the baleful influence of Medicare that has, again, 50% lower prices than private payers pay, that that we're going to somehow unleash this competitive revolution when we know there's lots of other markets in which that have some of these characteristics where there's enormous distortions and enormous amounts of lobbying that take place. I would note, for example, that like our technology sector has a lot of characteristics that economists have shown are not conducive to a free play of competition. And the point is not to say that we can't encourage more and more effective ways of getting value. The point is to say that we should not make basic security hostage to that, and we should not throw away the tools that we have and using them better in the future. So this is a real system, right? It may not seem as great as the idealized one, the visions that sometimes get offered, but it builds on the market system we have in a pragmatic way that makes fundamental change possible over time. I don't know exactly how that change, where that change will go, but I do think that the public option can make our markets work better, and I do think this is a distinctly American solution that builds on the most popular insurance plan in the country, and probably the largest and most popular in the world, alongside Medicaid, and it empowers Americans to choose, to encourage them to choose among plans, encouraging companies to compete, creating opportunities for Americans to lead healthy lives free from the risks and uncertainties and crushing burdens of healthcare costs as we tackle this enormous problem. So thank you so much for having me here today, and thank you so much, David, for this civil dialogue, which I hope can be modeled in our political system someday. So thanks.
5 minutes of rebuttal. Thank you, Jacob. 5 minutes of five minutes of summary from you, David. You can take the podium. You can sit. Either way, take it away, David.
No, I'll sit. And thank you, Jacob. I completely agree on the dialogue. And I do want to answer your question because I think it's an important question. But first and most importantly, my mother is here tonight. In The Brothers Karamazov, the old man, the enfeebled, hopeless, near the end of his life, is 55 years old. I am 64. I think of you as a kid. Enviously. And my mother has informed me that she is exactly 12 years older than I am. And that's the most information I can give on that. My mother is having some work done on her hip. She's hoping to avoid a hip. I understand this is a HIPAA violation. arrest me. Is hoping to avoid a full hip replacement, but she's having a lot of treatments done on her hip because she finds that when she walks the mile every day to her office, she feels discomfort. That is American healthcare in 2025. That's not the system we built this for. It's a great thing. It's going to be a better thing. Healthcare didn't do a lot of good for a long time, but increasingly it is. And we're going to have to come up with a different way to pay for that. It's going to have to look normal. We're going to have to use insurance for the things that are insurable, unexpected and major. We're going to have to use savings for the things that are major and predictable, getting older. We're going to have to use out-of-pocket for routine things. How are we going to get there? We're going to get there by starting. Not radically overhauling this, not needing the government to do anything or doing little things, but at the margin, we're going to say, instead of doing the Medicare pretend we're driving prices lower, Medicare is actually going to create the conditions for providers to compete on price, which it doesn't do today. We're going to do that throughout the government. We're going to do that in the way we regulate hospitals. For those of you who think about safety in healthcare, I've spent the last 10 years as chair of our biggest private hospital safety organization. The biggest problem we have is that the government, the hospital's business partner in the current system, have a hard time effectively regulating your business partner. In the same way, for the last gentleman's question, the more we can get politics out of this, the more likely we are to have the type of dynamism and responsiveness we'll need for the 21st century. The less public option, the less government attempt to buy healthcare for us, they can help finance it, they can help get money to people who can't afford it, but the less we have government actually pay for it, the less conflicted it will be in regulating its business partner. That's much more important in the details than you can imagine, and certainly not part of what I would call the naive case of what health insurance has gotten us. We don't have health insurance. We have what you'd have if Rube Goldberg and Bernie Madoff had a child, which in these fluid times is possible. It looks like nothing elsewhere. And let me get to Jacob's question. No one else on Earth does what I'm proposing. Maybe Singapore does in some important ways. But no one else on Earth is doing what the United States is doing right now. In envy, lots of health experts say, gee, I wish we had the universalism they had abroad, and under their breath, the price controls. But that came with something that Americans were never going to accept. Every foreign system has a budget. No one has an entitlement. No one has this idea we have in Medicare, and for the most part in Medicaid, a little more restricted, that anything you need, you should be able to get. No one else does that. The United States traded universalism for scope, which is why you have the waiting lists and the, you know, limited procedures in other countries. Maybe that's a trade you would want to make, but there's no chance that would get passed in an American legislature. So let's go back to Jacob's point. What do we do with the path dependence we have as Americans? We want the ability to buy anything we can afford, and we don't want the government telling us we can't, which means we can't really have a government system. We've played with it for a while. It's gotten insanely expensive. It's bankrupting us. We can't really afford to put $2 to $3 million each into the system over our lifetimes. What are we going to do? We're going to do something different. What I'm proposing is not a radical reform. It's starting on the margins and moving in. 20, 30 years from now, we will have a healthcare system that looks a lot more like the normal economy, which is good because it's 20% of the economy. It'll take time, but I think we'll see returns pretty quickly. And I'd rather do that than, with all respect, add yet another leg to this ridiculously complex system where the complexity itself explains part of the reason it's both so expensive and so unresponsive to your needs. There's 340 million stories of how this healthcare system, 60 years in, isn't working at $5 trillion a year.
Thank you, David, and that concludes the meeting. Lucas, please open the voting. I have in my hand the Soul Forum Tootsie Roll that goes to the Oxford-style winner of this debate. I, of course, remind Jacob that the initial vote was the control, you know. And, yes, and so the fact that there might be a libertarian
leaning in this audience in a way counts against David rather than for him. You understand, this is developed at Oxford. How can we argue with it? But anyway, it's Oxford-style voting. Yeah. Okay. Yes, I do again want to repeat the resolution. The government should offer to all Americans a health insurance plan that would compete with private insurance plans. The most gracious moment of the evening was certainly expressed by Jacob, with the usual regret. So many of your questions were not answered, and this time, both debaters will be at our party two blocks uptown. You can follow me on my cane to the place. That'll be a little slow. You can follow lots of other people who know where it is, 55 Great Jones Street, just two blocks uptown from here, where there is a large loft apartment awaiting you with delicious food prepared by my wife, Hisako. So do please join us. And if you haven't paid for the party, please donate big time tomorrow morning to the Soul Forum. This will be a tax deductible for you, so please do recognize that. There is a big fat donate button at thesohoforum.org. I want to take a moment while you are voting to announce that we do indeed have debates every month, July and August included, and our next debate will be on August 12th, and it will be about President Trump's deportation policies. We've already sold half the hall. It will be held here. We've already sold half the hall for that one because in that particular case, we have at least a semi-celebrity, Glenn Greenwald, coming up from Brazil to debate immigration lawyer Anna Gorish on this issue of President Trump's deportation policies. That is August 12th. A Tuesday, while you're donating tomorrow, I suggest you buy your tickets because that could be very quickly sold out. In September, we are going to have a debate on paying for sex, a slightly racier subject than this evening. Paying for sex should be a crime. That will be between Melanie Thompson and Caitlin Bailey. That's September 15th, 2025. And on Tuesday, October 21st, we are going to be debating decriminalizing drugs. And that will be between Yale professor Kevin Sabet versus Reason senior producer Zach Weissmuller. In November, we have to nail the date. In November, we will be debating affirmative action featuring Jason Riley from the Manhattan Institute, who has written a book about the subject. Also, a little bit more inside baseball, we are looking to have a bonus debate in about a month on the mayoral campaign in New York City. We are trying to get a couple of prominent people. We are told that if we do actually get the candidates for mayor, then we'll have to get them all. There's a certain restriction on that. So we can't get the candidates for mayor, but we can get some pretty good spokespeople for them. And that we will probably have uptown at Symphony Space, which has nearly two and a half times the room of this hall. And so we are looking closely at that bonus debate on an issue that's on the mind of every New Yorker. Lucas, it looks as though you can give me the results and tell me who gets the Tootsie Roll. Okay,
Well, all right. I guess I'd have to say that there was a decline in the yes vote from 51% to 34%. So that decline put you at a disadvantage, Jacob, and there was an increase in the no vote from 20% to 51%, giving the Tootsie Roll to David Goldhill. Thank you both. What? Superb job done by both, and David has offered to split the Tootsie Roll. We'll do that operation at our home in two blocks uptown. See you then.